Welcome everyone. It's my pleasure to have Ryan Rogers here. Ryan is a PhD candidate at Penn and working with Aaron Roth and Michael Kearns. Ryan has done some very interesting work on differential privacy, machine learning, and algorithmic game theory. And he'll tell us about how to leverage privacy in data analysis.
Thanks, Nikhil. Yeah, so just want to talk to you all about some recent work I've been doing on trying to use some of the very useful properties of differential privacy to solve new problems in data analysis. Okay. Okay, so I want to think of a very general model for data analysis. We have some researcher that's going to come in and pose some question, and so it wants to run some analysis or test T, and so it's then going to go out into the real world and sample some data, draw an IID from some population, run the test on this data, and receive the corresponding outcome. Okay, perhaps the researcher has made some great discovery based on this outcome and can publish the result in some very prestigious journal. However, as is often the case in research, perhaps the analyst found that there is nothing significant with his result. Now, unfortunately, his career depends on finding significant results, and so might want to think of some new analysis or test T prime, which is now a function of what he's already seen. Okay, so ideally what we would like is for the analyst to go out and sample a fresh data set drawn from the same population to run this new test on, and then receive the corresponding outcome. And the reason that it's ideal is that there's just a lot of existing theory from statistics that the analyst would be able to use, and it crucially assumes that the test that's selected is independent of the data. Okay, and so here on the left-hand side, I have this sort of ideal setting of data analysis where I can sample fresh data with each analysis I pick. However, data collection is expensive, so a more realistic setting is to think of the analyst as sort of reusing the same data set for multiple adaptively chosen analyses. And so our question now is, how can we still ensure statistically valid answers to these adaptively chosen analyses? How can we make sure that the answers to these different analyses actually will generalize to the underlying population? Okay, and sort of if we were to use the same, the theory from the ideal world in this more realistic setting, this often causes overfitting or often spurious results. And there's been many journal articles or pop culture references saying that empirical science is just broken. Okay, and so kind of the primary suspect behind this is that we're sort of using this ideal world setting of data analysis and using those results in this more realistic, adaptive data analysis setting. Okay, so I'm going to think of data analysis as actually being inherently adaptive. Now, this sort of setting can kind of capture some self-contained tasks, like I want to do some feature selection followed by some least squares regression, or it might be a little bit more difficult to pin down how the adaptivity is occurring. Maybe you have multiple researchers, they're sharing the same data set, and one right after another, they want to reuse the data set to run different analyses. So we ask, can we still provide statistically valid answers to these adaptively chosen analyses? And the traditional approach here is that we can, with each analysis, we can split the data and use each chunk of data for each of the different analyses. So the limitation with this approach is that the amount of data that we need is going to have to scale linearly with the number of analyses that we want to run. Okay, so we'll quickly run out of data as we're asking more and more analyses. Okay, so a new approach that I want to talk about with you today was proposed in work from Dwork, Feldman, Hart, Potassi, Reingold, and Roth, I guess now 2 years ago, that looks at limiting the amount of information that's learned about the data set with each analysis. Okay, so if we can limit the amount of information that's learned about the data set with each choice of tests that we pick, then we can treat the analysis as being close to independent of the data. So if I think of this answer, little a, to be a noisy version of the actual answer, then I can kind of control how much information I'm learning about the data set. If there's so much noise here that the test is actually, that the answer is actually independent of the data, then there's no problem here. However, if I'm giving the true answer, then we run the risk of overfitting. So what is this trade-off between the two? Okay, and so sort of with for mathematical convenience, what I'm going to do is look at this post-processing function and the analysis. I'm going to call that all just one function called a test selection procedure. Okay, so I want to look at my focus here is going to be limiting the amount of information that's learned about the data set through this test selection procedure, capital A. Okay, and we can think of A, we're going to be think of it here as some randomized mapping. Okay, and the extra benefit that we get out of this is that the amount of data that we'll need is actually going to scale sublinearly with the number of analyses, seeing this added benefit over traditional data splitting. Okay, so this problem of adaptive data analysis has been studied in the statistics literature for many decades. However, they're focused on specific types of sequences of analyses, such as this example of doing lasso model selection followed by least squares regression. And so in this recent work from Dwork et al., they want to look at this more general results. How can I look at arbitrary orderings of analyses and control for the adaptivity of these tests? Okay, and then since that, there's been many nice follow-up works looking at specific types of analyses that you want to run on the data, specifically like low sensitivity queries or analyses. And also there's been some impossibility results showing that adaptive data analysis is in fact hard. Okay, so here's the outline of my talk. So I want to cover some of the contributions my collaborators and I have made in understanding adaptive data analysis. So I'll start by giving this an information measure on a test selection procedure or algorithm so that if we can bound this measure, then we can control for this adaptivity in our analyses, and we can still obtain valid results. And so specifically, I'll talk about the application to post-selection hypothesis testing. Okay, and so this measure, which we'll call max information, was known previously to partially unify some of the existing types of algorithms that had good or strong generalization guarantees in this adaptive setting. And so we then extend this connection to also include types of algorithms that have a stability condition called approximate differential privacy. And this connection between approximate differential privacy and max information is going to be crucial in showing that our techniques actually will improve over traditional data splitting. Now, note that attached to each differentially private algorithm or analysis is some privacy parameter. And there's been a rich theory in differential privacy composition that says that these privacy parameters degrade gracefully, even sublinearly, with the number of analyses that you run on the same data set. And it's precisely this sublinear composition of differential privacy which is going to allow us to improve over data splitting techniques. Okay. However, there is a caveat to these composition theorems from differential privacy. And granted, differential privacy was not made specifically for this adaptive data analysis setting. And so in the second part of my talk, I'm going to talk about a new framework of differential privacy composition where we can allow the privacy parameters and the number of analyses that you want to run to be chosen adaptively, to also be not fixed up front. Okay, and so this is sort of the natural way of thinking of differential privacy composition. Different differentially private algorithms have different utility privacy trade-offs. So as I'm interacting with the data set, I would like to tune these parameters as I'm learning or adaptively selecting new tests to run. And so I'll propose a new definition for differential privacy composition in the setting and also provide a sublinear composition bound, even when the parameters can be chosen adaptively. Now, in these results are only useful if we actually have some differentially private analyses to run on my data. So I then will talk about some specific types of analyses that you might want to run on your data set, specifically with hypothesis tests, and how we can make them differentially private to ensure statistical validity. Okay, and then I'll finish up the talk with directions for future work. So let's get started with this connection of max information with differential privacy and how that can help us in the problem of post-selection hypothesis testing. So first, I want to talk about what types of procedures we want to allow the analyst to run. And for that, we're going to talk about max information. And if we have an algorithm that has small max information, then we can think of the test selection procedure and the data as being close to independent. In this closeness, there's some correction factor that we have to take into account. And so that correction factor is just given by the max information bound. And here, let me sort of unpack what this definition is, which was proposed in the work from Dwork et al. So in the denominator here, what we have is sort of this ideal setting that we want to bound. So here we're looking at the probability distribution between the test selection procedure ran on an independent copy of my data and the data itself. Okay? And so this is precisely the quantity that we can use several decades of statistics results in bounding, is where the test I selected is totally independent of my data. Okay? And this numerator is then this real-world setting. This is the quantity in which we want to bound. We want to look at what type, the probability distribution between the test selection procedure and the data set when the test selection procedure is ran on the same exact data. Okay, so bounding this quantity is precisely this correction factor that we're going to need to bound.
What is O?
What is O? O is just set of outcomes. Sorry. So yeah, O is going to be the set of outcomes that my algorithm or data set could have been. So it's like a tuple. Okay, so that was max information between two random variables, the test selection procedure and the data. So now I want to talk about what max information is of an algorithm. So the max information of an algorithm for data sets of size n is going to be the following, where we're just going to look at worst case probability distributions. So what's the worst product distribution that could have generated my data and look at the max information of that quantity. Okay. So now let me talk about the specific running example throughout this talk, which is going to be hypothesis testing, a type of analysis that the analyst might want to actually run. Okay, so what is a hypothesis test? So just very roughly, we can think of it as just being a mapping from data sets into some conclusion. And the conclusion is either going to be to reject some null hypothesis, which is just some model of what we're guessing the data is coming from. Or it's going to just be inconclusive. It'll produce, it'll provide no conclusion. Okay, and here, the null hypothesis we can think of as just being a subset of data distributions. And there's a corresponding statistic as well that just maps the data to some real value. And we're going to use this test statistic to determine how likely is my data to have been generated from my null hypothesis. So the types of errors that I can make in this is that if I have my test rejecting the null hypothesis, then we say a false discovery has occurred if the null hypothesis was in fact true. Okay? And typically in hypothesis testing, we think of this as a hard constraint. We want to bound the probability of false discovery of our test by at most some threshold alpha. Think of it as like 5% or 1%. Okay? But also, a trivial hypothesis test that achieves this is just to never always fail to reject the null hypothesis. Okay? And so we actually want our test to be able to reject some false null hypotheses. And so for that, we call that the power of our test. Okay? So we want to ensure that our test has a bounded probability of false discovery, but we also want it to be able to correctly reject some false null hypotheses. Okay? So what do we use to determine how to reject a null hypothesis or not? Well, typically, we use what's called a p-value. And a p-value is just associated with some value and some distribution under the null hypothesis. and is given as the following quantity. And for this, we can just think of it as the probability of observing some value of the test statistic that is at least as extreme as this value y. And so here, for one-sided tests, we can think of p-values as being the probability of seeing this value or anything larger than it. So it's this tail area of my distribution under the null hypothesis. Okay, and so note that if we were to plug in our test statistic value evaluated on the data into this p-value, then the p-value is just some uniform random variable. Okay, and so if the data is actually generated from under the null hypothesis, then a p-value is uniform, and it's precisely this connection that we use in order to bound the probability of false discovery. If the p-value is at most alpha when we evaluate it on the test statistic, then that ensures that the probability of false discovery is also at most alpha. However, this theory completely breaks down when the test that we select is now a function of the data. Okay, and this is precisely the problem in adaptive data analysis. So how do we correct for this? So for that, I'm thinking that we still want to ensure that our test has a bounded probability of false discovery, but also in this adaptive setting. So I'm then going to propose a very natural way in which we can correct these p-values to ensure that we still have a bounded probability of false discovery. So for that, here I'm thinking of my test as being selected as a function of the data. And I'm going to reject the null hypothesis as long as the p-value on the test statistic is less than some function of the probability of false discovery that I'm after. Okay, so I might have to make this p-value slightly smaller in order to reject the null hypothesis, but this whole procedure should have probability at most alpha of a false discovery. Okay, so when I select my test as a function of the data, I then correct my p-values and reject it only if it's smaller than this corrected value, and that will lead to a probability of false discovery at most alpha. And I then call gamma a valid p-value correction. Okay. Yep.
Oh, yeah, just trying to pass this. So, if you run two tests, is your probability of false discovery the probability of a false discovery in either of them, or just in the second?
Yeah, so here I'm going to think about only on the last one. So we've done some adaptive stuff before, and I want to ensure probability of false discovery most alpha on perhaps this last one.
So, of course, you still have a problem that if you do 20 tests, then one of them.
Yeah, so then you look into like family-wise error or other things to control that. Okay, so why introduce max information and these p-values? Well, it turns out that max information will allow you to get a valid p-value correction. And so what I mean by that is that if we just have some test selection procedure with bounded max information at most m, little m, then a valid p-value correction is just the following. And so here, if I have a very large bound on the probability on my max information, then the p-value correction is extremely small. Okay? And so if my p-value correction is extremely small, then that will make it very, very hard to ever reject the null hypothesis. So the larger my max information is, the worse my power would be. Okay? So I'm after just like kind of small, I want to attain a very good bound on the max information to obtain a reasonable valid p-value correction. So let's just see a very simple proof of this, why this is the case. And this sort of falls out exactly from the definition of max information. Okay, so I'm just defining some set to be the possible outcomes that could have led to a false discovery. Okay, so just writing that out, my p-value would be, if I reject, it would be smaller than this corrected value, and I selected my test under the with this test selection procedure A, but the null hypothesis was in fact true. Writing it in just another way, we've just defined this set S to be precisely this event. And so now we can just use max information, the bound on max information, to obtain this quantity. So we have to correct it by this 2 to the m factor and this additive beta. Here we're thinking of beta as being extremely small. But now this quantity is precisely what we can use when the test is selected independently of the data. And so now this is just a uniform, and we can bound uniform random variables so that we can bound this by gamma of alpha. So then plugging in this gamma of alpha here would ensure that this is at most alpha. Okay, so hopefully I've convinced you that max information is useful in this post-selection hypothesis testing. So what algorithms actually have bounded? Yeah.
Is this also a lower bound?
No, we don't have any lower bounds for these sort of results yet. That is definitely a direction of future work. Okay, so what procedures actually have bounded max information? So in the work, initial work that introduced max information from Dworkin et al., we have these two types of algorithms that have bounded max information. So the first is pure differential privacy. And for now, just think of it as some algorithmic stability condition. And also, we have algorithms that have bounded description length. So this is where our max information bound is in terms of the size of the image of our mapping. Okay, and so separately, these two procedures were shown to have good generalization properties in this adaptive setting. And so max information can be thought of as sort of this unifying measure in this for generalization in this adaptive data analysis setting. Okay, and however, with these results, with pure differential privacy, it leaves out a very important case of what's called approximate differential privacy. So approximate differential privacy is a much larger class of algorithms, but also we're able to obtain much more accurate answers with approximate differential privacy than with pure differential privacy. In fact, there are very strong lower bounds in pure differential privacy that show us that we cannot achieve some level of accuracy that we can break with whenever we go to approximate differential privacy. Okay. So now I want to go into a crash course on differential privacy. However, it was introduced at Microsoft. So who all has seen differential privacy before? Should I still go over? Okay. So differential privacy has been around for now a little over a decade. And here it was introduced from Dworkin, McSherry, Nassim, and Smith. And it considers a data set. And here the data set is fixed. It's not some random variable. It's not coming from some product distribution or anything. And each data record of my data set is controlled by some individual. And here each person is going to report their data to some centralized algorithm. And this algorithm is going to be flipping some coins. So this algorithm itself is randomized. And because it's randomized, it will produce some outcome distribution given this particular input. Now, if one person, say, if I were to change my data, then the resulting outcome distribution should also change. So I would obtain this slightly different, output distribution. And what differential privacy guarantees is that these two data distributions should be very close to one another. Note, if they were right on top of each other, then somebody that sees an outcome from either of these output distributions would not be able to distinguish whether it came from the data set with my original data or with my changed data. Yeah, so we'll get into what I mean by close. Okay, so good. So writing that down in mathematics, what does that mean? So we say that a randomized algorithm is differentially private if for all neighboring data sets, these are data sets that differ in at most one entry, and then the output distribution should be close to one another on either of these neighboring data sets. And closeness here, epsilon, this e to the epsilon, you can think of as like a 1 plus epsilon multiplicative factor between the two. And delta here is this small additive difference between them as well. So we think of delta as being extremely small. And from this definition, we can see the difference between pure differential privacy and approximate differential privacy. Pure differential privacy is where delta is equal to 0, and otherwise we say that it's approximate differential privacy. So in order to see the gain that we get from approximate differential privacy, I've said that we can obtain more accurate things, but one of the most useful things from differential privacy is that it composes. Okay, so if I were to run a bunch of differentially private algorithms on the same data set, then the resulting composed algorithm is also differentially private. But you can imagine that as I'm learning more and more about the data set with each analysis, I should be making the privacy worse. I should be learning more about the data. So how does the privacy degrade? And so in the original work of differential privacy, they show that if each algorithm is epsilon pure differentially private, then the composed algorithm is epsilon k pure differentially private. But then in follow-up work from Dwork, Rothblum, and Vadhan, the composed algorithm, if we just relax the condition from pure differential privacy to approximate differential privacy, we can get this quadratic improvement. Okay, so now rather than epsilon times k, it's now epsilon root k. Yeah.
Composing, because on your previous slide, the input was on this product space, d to the n, and the output is just arbitrary.
Yeah, so what I mean by that is, so in the beginning of my talk, I just had one analysis, but perhaps you want to do multiple analyses on the same data.
You're not composing functions.
But you are in that the previous outcomes, you use the previous outcomes to then select a new differentially private algorithm. So you can adaptively select a new algorithm based on the previous outputs. And so then you can see this whole composed thing as just one differentially private algorithm.
You mean there's a standard mathematical notion of composition where you apply a function to the output of the other function, and this is not exactly what you're doing.
Yeah, so you're sort of using it and reusing the same data. Yeah.
So what is data in this? Like, is data the same data that you would have like for Iran through AK?
Or no,
no. Like so each one of these algorithms is still epsilon pure differentially private. Mm-hmm. I'm just allowing a little bit of slack in the composed algorithm.
But you're keeping the amount of slack private from us?
So no, this can be released, this delta.
Can you release it to us?
Yes. Oh, the dependence? Yeah, so here we have a square root k log 1 over delta.
So for any delta, you get a
yes,
log
and delta can be exponentially small in the size of your data or in the number of analyses. Okay, so this we get a quadratic improvement, and it's precisely this connection which is going to help us showing that we actually get an improvement over data splitting. Okay, so now that's our crash course in differential privacy. Let's come back to adaptive data analysis. So we have this connection of post-selection hypothesis testing, where we showed already, we actually proved that if we have an algorithm with bounded max information, that'll lead to valid p-value correction, and we can bound the probability of false discovery. What I'm going to talk about now is that if we have an algorithm that's approximate differentially private, then it will lead, then that algorithm also has bounded max information. Okay, so what was known prior in this work from Dwork et al. Is that if we have a pure differentially private algorithm, then we get the following max information bound. And here, epsilon, we're thinking of being small, so this squared epsilon is even smaller. And in our results, we show that if we even go to a looser approximate differential privacy, then we could obtain a similar bound on the max information. Okay. And here the beta is still extremely small because we're thinking of delta as being also extremely small.
So the tilde, does it hide any delta dependence?
It does. So delta, the tilde here is hiding log dependence on delta and other log dependence on perhaps n and 1 over epsilon. Yeah.
Sorry, another question. Can you provide some intuition about the distinction between the epsilon and the delta? I mean, I realize one's multiplicative and the other's additive, but why should one care so much about
it? Yes, so I will go exactly over consequences of this result,
okay.
Why we care.
Okay.
So why do we care about this positive result? So right now it just seems pretty incremental going from pure differential privacy to approximate differential privacy. However, one thing that we can say is that we can recover some of the optimal results from previous work in this Basili, Nassim, Smith, Steinke, Stemmer, and Ullman for specific types of queries. However, our results apply much more generally, and this adaptive hypothesis testing framework kind of falls outside of this low sensitivity query framework. Okay, but this composition is really where we see the main power of this result. Okay, so if we compose k-adaptively selected pure differentially private procedures, so I'm reusing the same data set, and each one is pure differentially private, then the max information of the composed algorithm, looking at grouping together that entire interaction as just one thing, then utilizing the previous results from Dworak et al. Has this quadratic dependence on k. Okay. However, with our results, because we can now use the result, the strong composition guarantee of Dworak, Roth, Bloom, and Budhan, we can get a quadratic improvement in the number of analyses that we run. So now we can run quadratically more adaptively selected algorithms on the same data set without achieving a worse p-value correction. Okay. So I want to go over a very toy example of why we can actually see an improvement over data splitting. Okay, so for this toy example, bear with me, just we say that we've already ran k adaptively selected tests, and I'll kind of distinguish how we did the adaptivity before, but for now just think of we've ran k adaptively selected analyses and we want to run one more. Okay, and here let's think of the data as just being very simple. It's Gaussian with some unknown mean but known variance 1. And after all these analyses, these k different adaptively chosen analyses, I come up with this null hypothesis that I want to test. So based on previous outcomes, this is the null hypothesis that I want to run. So I want to test whether the mean is actually 0 or whether it's some positive amount. Okay. And so note that the goals from hypothesis testing is that I want to be able to bound the probability of false discovery at most alpha, but I also want good power. So by that, what I want is, as I collect more data, I want to be able to distinguish between these two models. So as I collect more and more data, if my data is actually generated from the alternate hypothesis, then I want to be able to reject. Okay, so now let's compare data splitting with this differential privacy method. Okay, so with data splitting, because I've done k plus 1 adaptively chosen analyses, I needed to break my data up into n over k plus 1 chunks and run each analysis on each one.
You mean k plus 1 chunks of size?
Yes, yes. So here this x bar is the sample mean, but it's a sample mean of only these n over k plus 1 points. Okay. And so note that under the null hypothesis, we form this statistic, this z-score, just because this thing is standard normal. And under the alternate, it's Gaussian, but with a slightly different mean. Now, under differential privacy, note that we're reusing the same data set. So the full data set we're reusing. And so our test statistic here is just going to be the sample mean divided by its standard deviation. And so here we get to use the entire data set. And so under the null hypothesis is standard normal, but under the alternate, it's this Gaussian with a slightly different mean. Now back to data splitting, we don't have to do a p-value correction to ensure this probability of false discovery. We've already done this. This is why we partition the data into these different k plus one bins. Okay. So this critical value, this z naught, this value in which we're going to reject the null hypothesis, does not need to grow, doesn't need to change. We don't need to modify that. However, with the differential privacy approach, we do. So if each of the k previous rounds were done with an epsilon differentially pure differentially private algorithm, then I have the following max information bound, and so I have to correct my p-value based on that. Okay, and here I'm eliminating the beta. We're thinking of beta as being extremely small. And so this is hiding the dependence on delta, but it's only logarithmic dependence. And so here, this is utilizing our improved max information bound for the composed algorithm. And so note that this critical value now, because our probability on the tail is getting smaller, in which we actually have to reject, this critical value is actually getting pushed. So as we're increasing k, we have to move our critical value further away. OK, so let's look at our power analysis of data splitting. If k is larger than n, there's nothing we can hope for power, right? There's not even enough data in each bin, right? We're dealing with a fraction of a data point in each bin. Now with differential privacy, when k is much larger than n, we can still set a privacy parameter so that our critical value is increasing slower than the null hypothesis, than the alternate hypothesis mean. So because now as n gets larger, we can actually see a gap between the point in which we reject and where our data is actually concentrated around. OK, so this little toy example kind of shows that we're able to achieve this improvement over data splitting using these sort of techniques. Yes?
So if you look at this particular problem you set up, you can compute a Poisson distribution over mu. And then you can answer any question about mu.
Yeah.
So how does that compare with the usage of data in this way?
Yeah, so using this little toy example, there are probably other ways of doing this approach. I just wanted to kind of compare these sort of naive things. But there could be smarter ways in which to achieve an improvement. I was thinking there are probably other null hypotheses that you can test too, where you might be able to obtain this sort of thing. The point here is that this correction, because the critical value is decaying exponentially, we don't need to correct the p-value so that this thing is constant. So that's sort of the gain. So any sort of null hypothesis where we can get this tail probability exponentially small, then that's where we can get the improvement.
So assuming this isn't the last test you're going to run, this itself, you have to do some differential private.
Yes.
And on top of it, so there's some loss because of that, which you're not counting here.
So you have to know up front how many analyses you're going to run. So in differential in data splitting, you would have to know how large k is to begin with, right? You're going to say I'm going to run k plus one analyses up front. Differential privacy is the same thing,
right?
But I'm going to later talk about an improvement over that.
My question is, you also have to add some noise to this.
Yes. This idea, so the previous analyses need to be differentially private.
But this analysis,
does not need to be.
Like I said, if it's the last test you're going
if to it's
run,
the last one.
So this
gets into how we set this parameter. Okay. So good. So when k is equal to n, this epsilon is like 1 over root n. Okay, if the previous analyses just depended on like a statistical query, then the noise that we're adding is on scale with the sample variance, the sample standard deviation. So we're actually not losing anything when k equals n. When k equals n squared, epsilon is like 1 over n. And when epsilon is 1 over n, we're thinking that the output is actually totally independent of the data. Because in differential privacy, what that would mean is that you could change every data record of your data set, and you would still obtain the same sort of output. And so in that case, we're thinking of it being completely independent. So here, the trade-off really is in between this linear dependence on k and this quadratic n squared. So at each round, you would have to sacrifice a little bit of error, but then you would be able to guarantee validity over the entire sequence. And you could correct the previous analyses for that sort of error.
So all the previous ones can be tests of the same nature, where you test the mean of.
Yes, and I'll talk about later, like different differentially private hypothesis tests. Good. Okay, so that's sort of the connection of max information with differential privacy and how we can potentially improve over data splitting techniques. Now, something that was kind of hinted at was that in these sort of applying these composition bounds, we need to know what the privacy parameters and how many analyses we want to run we're going to be up front. Okay, so here is the sort of setting of differential privacy composition that's thought of in the traditional setting. Okay, so here we run some algorithm that's differentially private with some privacy parameter. We see some outcome. Based on that outcome, we're going to think of some new differentially private algorithm and run that thing on the same data and receive the outcome. And we can do this for many rounds. And so what we want to know in composition is, how does the privacy degrade? So what functions of the privacy parameters that I've used would ensure that the compose algorithm is actually differentially private?
Sorry, just to understand this, I want to make sure we understand the previous example you gave. So can you tell us what is a concrete example of the previous, say we have k equals n and we're running these n tests.
So say like even outside of hypothesis testing, maybe the previous rounds you just wanted to ask a statistical query on your data?
Can
empirical mean? Like you wanted to know the average of one of your variables? And so you ask what that is first, you get the answer, you adaptively select a different mean to ask. Maybe the data set is short and fat, so there's a large number of features that you can ask means on. Okay, so I'm adaptively going to select another mean to ask, and I want to ensure that
the data was x, you assumed x1 to xn were normal, you had those two hypotheses. So what is an so I don't understand what. So one, you just have a single parameter mu.
Right.
So what are the tests you could do besides testing?
So I guess with that example, like knowing these k previous things, there weren't all these like empirical means that you could have asked because it's only one dimensional. But perhaps you could think of a data set as being a lot of different features, and you ran just different means before, and then you came to some null hypothesis that you wanted to test at the end.
So have you worked out such an example where you have all the n things?
Yeah, so we know specifically with if we were to ask just statistical queries, that we can ask it at like n squared many of them and still obtain generalization guarantees. But these are with the case of just statistical queries. So we wanted to extend this beyond to hypothesis testing. And so that is a little bit more delicate. And so that we haven't worked out exactly an example that would work all the way through. But we know that we can improve with just statistical queries using the previous results. And we know that this max information connection would then allow us to apply that sort of improvement to hypothesis testing. And so potential hypothesis tests you might want to run might be much more complicated than this. So in the later hypothesis tests I'll mention, we're looking at data that could be like a histogram with like D many bends. And so with that, you might be able to, this multinomial or multivariate data distribution, you might be able to show improvements.
So sorry, when you say statistical queries, do you mean estimating a parameter, is that what you mean?
So statistical queries in that you're like asking how many people in your data satisfy some condition.
Okay.
So it's like a mean of your data.
Okay, so it's an estimation. I mean, hypothesis test is a statistical query, but you're talking...
In hypothesis tests, I guess you want to control like this probability of false discovery and power of your test. So you want to be able to make these sort of conclusions. You can embed that sort of in statistical queries. So maybe you can do something with just the statistical query itself. But maybe your query that you base...
In the type of query you're talking about, it's an estimate, and what do you want
to say? So if your statistic that you're running is perhaps high sensitivity, so you can't, like it's not, for means it's like 1 over n, so you can just collect more data and you get a more accurate answer. But in this p-value setting, you don't get concentration. It's not a low sensitivity query. Yes?
But this example makes me think an alternative to trying to use the data the best way you can is to fit a density model and then ask more questions on the density model rather than on the original data itself. And then p-value is kind of the uncertainty in the model.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow in the limit, the two techniques things should converge to the same sort of usage of the data.
Right.
But I'm not sure that this is the case of that. For example, what if you ask the question, you already rejected the hypothesis that the mean is positive. Now you ask the question, is the mean less than 5?
Mm-hmm.
Or less than minus 5? Those are very different, because you know that it's less than minus 5, or it should have high probability, and that it's less than 5, it's a different kind of probability. So there's correlation between questions you're asking.
Yeah.
And this is not taking that into account, is it?
So it is. You can do whatever you want based on the previous answers. These can be very dependent on what you've already seen.
And you do take into account, say.
But the point is that sometimes they're very dependent, sometimes they're less dependent, and when they're less dependent, you would want to take advantage of that. But here, you're...
Yeah, and so this dependence is what we're sort of bounding with this max information quantity.
So do they then, do you have examples where they converge to the same thing, but the information is used the same way, using two different approaches? Like in this case, if you compute the posterior distribution of the mean, answer every question, are you using the data as efficiently when you're doing hypothesis testing? Many, many hypothesis tests.
Yeah, so as far as like a practical application, like we have not done this sort of thing. Yeah.
You look into how it's affected by like whether the dimensions are dependent or independent of each other. So
what?
Like if some of the attributes we're looking at in the data are, let's say, length, width, height versus
yeah.
then...
So independence testing, I will talk about a differentially private independence testing that we can do. And because it's differentially private, we know that we can bound its max information, and we can obtain still these generalization guarantees.
That's not quite what I'm saying. It's like sometimes you know there are some dimensions that are dependent, that are of the same domain.
Okay, so some prior knowledge into your data that you might know. Yeah, you can perhaps pre-process on that to sort of try to fix what sort of analyses you might run later.
So essentially, you want to apply this at an entirely like independent attribute. As much as you can. I know.
Yeah, I mean, like, oh, this would allow that you could have some dependence between these features. And so if you already know up front that certain things are independent, then you can just run these analyses and not have to worry about bounding max information or anything, as long as you know that up front. But if you like test to see whether these things are independent or not, like that would leak information about your data with subsequent analyses.
We have a lot of questions that maybe we should let you finish and
yeah.
reserve them to the end.
Yeah, yeah. So I think what you're getting at is my future work slide in saying that we don't fully understand adaptive data analysis. Okay. So here's our sort of framework of just differential privacy composition. This was one of the biggest strengths of differential privacy and why it's so applicable. So we can form some of these building blocks that are differentially private, compose them together, and we get some really complicated algorithm that we can prove is differentially private. But we want to know what functions of the privacy parameters actually will lead to a differential privacy condition. Okay. But the caveat to this result is that these privacy parameters and K need to all be fixed up front. Okay? So prior to running anything, in order for you to compute this quantity and for this to be differentially private, you need to guarantee that you need to say what the parameters are up front. Okay, so in this fixed parameter setting, the sort of traditional way that we think of differential privacy, what sort of functions here are going to lead to the compose algorithm being differentially private? And here I've tacked on a delta into this function to show that perhaps we can weaken the restriction from pure differential privacy to approximate. And we've seen sort of this basic composition where we can just add up the privacy parameters. And we've seen this advanced composition where we get this like quadratic improvement on the number of analyses. And also, there's been follow-up work finding what is the optimal composition. So given some privacy parameters, what is the optimal way that we can bound the privacy laws? Okay, but the formulas for this are much too complicated to write down here. Okay, so what I'm after now is sort of this, in the setting of adaptive data analysis, looking at how these things compose, where we can choose the privacy parameters also as a function of what we've seen before. Okay, so our focus is that we want to allow the analyst to allocate his privacy budget adaptively as they're interacting with the data set, and also be able to adaptively select when to stop running analyses. So maybe up front he might say, I want to run 5,000 analyses, but after five, he's happy and wants to know how much privacy have I used up after this round. Okay, and so again, it's sort of natural to think of the analyst as being able to adaptively select these parameters and the number of analyses up front, or not up front, but adaptively, because different differentially private algorithms have different utility privacy trade-offs. So if I want to obtain some utility in some differentially private regression, that would be very different than obtaining the same sort of utility in perhaps estimating a mean. So these privacy parameters are sort of tuned in with the what differentially private algorithm we actually use. Okay, so some questions that we have are, which composition theorems actually still apply in this model? Can I just, like, after the fact, after I've adaptively selected these privacy parameters, then plug them in to these old functions, and that would give me a differentially private algorithm? Or can we define, or another fundamental question is, how do we even define differential privacy in this setting? Now that the privacy parameters are being chosen as a function of what you've already seen, these privacy parameters are now random variables themselves, and they might also leak information about the data. Okay, so the main character for this part of the story is the privacy loss random variable. So here, privacy loss random variable is going to be the following quantity. We're going to be looking at neighboring data sets and some algorithm. And the privacy loss random variable is just going to be looking at the log of this ratio between these two probabilities. And so note that if A, capital A, were pure differentially private, then this thing would be able to be bounded by plus or minus epsilon. So it would be no more than epsilon and no at least negative epsilon. Okay. And then when we treat these outcomes as coming from one of the output distribution of one of the data sets, then we can actually bound this quantity with by at most epsilon with very high probability if the algorithm is approximate differentially private. Okay, so the setting I'm imagining here is that at each round, the analyst is going to select a privacy parameter and an algorithm, which is that differentially private. And we're going to base this on the previous outcomes. And we want them to do this in some adversarial way. Okay, so letting them be adversarial just means that these we want these bounds to hold worst case. Okay, so what is the total privacy loss of this entire interaction? Well, looking at the privacy loss of the entire interaction for all these different outcomes, we just add up all the individual privacy losses, and we get this sort of quantity where we're conditioning on the previous outcomes. Okay, so note that if all these algorithms were differentially private, where we upfront told you what the privacy parameters were, then we would be able to then bounding this thing with high probability would ensure approximate differential privacy. So now we want to bound this quantity with high probability even when these bounds are random variables themselves. Okay, so what we then define is what's called a privacy odometer, what we call a privacy odometer, which just provides a running upper bound on the privacy loss. So we say that a valid privacy odometer is a function which parameterized by some failure probability, and it just says that we want to guarantee that our privacy loss over the entire interaction is at most this function of the privacy parameters that were actually used. Okay. So bounding this thing would ensure that we're bounding the probability of privacy loss. So this is the sort of setup I'm imagining. Here the analyst runs some differentially private algorithm with some privacy parameter, receives the outcome and the upper bound on the privacy loss that is already incurred, and then asks another analysis, so on and so forth. And so at the end sort of sees how many analyses, or what is the bound on the privacy loss. Now, it looks like up front here that I'm fixing what k is, how many analyses to run. But here you can think of as k as being just some very large or ridiculously large number. And so the analyst can select actually when to stop. And so they'll stop by just selecting epsilon to be 0 at some round and then 0 forever after. Okay, so in this model, we're allowing the analyst to adaptively select when to stop. Okay, so what are the results for this setting? Well, we can show that basic composition still applies. And so what I mean by that is that if we select these privacy parameters adaptively, then adding them up still provides an upper bound on the privacy laws. And so this is sort of in line with the basic composition theorem that was first introduced from the initial work of differential privacy. Okay, but what we're really after is a sublinear composition of the privacy parameters. So can we achieve that? And so what we do show is that we obtain this sort of this bound on the composition, which is going to be similar to what we had in the advanced composition theorem when we fixed the parameters. But now we have this log log n dependence. Okay, so n being the size of my data.
And what's hiding now in the O tilde?
O tilde, it's hiding the dependence on delta g, which is log 1 over delta. It's log 1 over delta is under the square root. Yep. But there's no other log dependence on n. Okay, so we show a bound under privacy loss random variable that's slightly worse than what we had before. And we show that this is, in fact, inherent, that there is no valid privacy odometer which improves on this log log n dependence. Okay?
I've actually never seen little O tildes.
Yeah, trying to clean up these bounds as much as possible. Okay. So maybe in the interest of time, I'll skip our proof sketch of this. But basically, it's an analysis of considering a random walk. And for anyone interested or that knows, this is just kind of like an application of the law of iterated logs in random walks. Okay. So then for the third part of my talk, I want to talk about what type of differentially private analyses you might actually want to run. So we've said that ensuring that the analyses are differentially private would ensure statistical validity over the entire sequence of analyses. But these are only useful if we actually have some differentially private analyses that we want to run. And so we then propose differentially private hypothesis tests that you might want to use. And so our goal is to obtain valid hypothesis tests, those that ensure this probability of false discovery in most alpha, and have decent power, and satisfy differential privacy. And the application of this is beyond adaptive data analysis. You might just have some sensitive data set of, say, medical records or movie rental history that you want to run some statistical inference on top of. Okay, so here's the basic setup for classical hypothesis testing, which you've already seen. You want to bound the probability of false discovery. So here I'm going to be looking at chi-squared tests. So here I'm thinking of my data as being categorical. And so I can represent my data as just a histogram of counts, where here, because it's a histogram of counts, I can think of my data as being generated from some multinomial distribution. And there's some unknown probability distribution, probability vector that generated it. Okay, so multinomial, just the generalization of a binomial, where instead of two outcomes, there's now d many outcomes. And the probability of being in each outcome is given by this probability vector. So a easy test that you might want to run is a goodness of fit, which is just, does the unknown null hypothesis, is the unknown probability vector equal to some given probability vector p naught? And there's also some more complicated ones that you might want to do, such as independence testing, where you want to know whether two categorical variables are independent of one another. And so this is a little bit more tricky to deal with in that it's a composite test. The data distribution is not completely determined by the null hypothesis. And so note that both of these classical tests use a chi-squared statistic, which can just kind of be summed up as looking at the observed count in each bin of our histogram from our data and subtracting off what it's expected to be under the null hypothesis. squaring it, dividing it by what it's expected to be, and summing it across all the different bends. So a very easy way to make this differentially private is to just add independent noise to each of the observed counts. Okay, so sort of adding noise to all the observed counts would ensure that we have differential privacy. So let's look at the specific problem of goodness of fit. We have some probability vector, and we want to test whether it's equal to some p naught. We add noise to the probability to the observed counts, where the noise can either be Gaussian or Laplace, depending on your privacy parameters. And so now what I want to plot are some results that we get. So what I'm plotting here is the empirical probability of false discovery of our test. Okay, so here in the x-axis is just the probability where we rejected the null hypothesis. But I'm generating my data from the null hypothesis, which is just a fourth, a fourth, a fourth, a fourth. And I want to test this. And so what I'm doing is I'm adding either Laplace noise or Gaussian noise to the observed count, as I talked about. And what the blue and yellow curves are showing me are the probability or the empirical probability of false discovery when I've added this noise and just used these off-the-shelf classical hypothesis tests. So such as like a Pearson chi-squared test. Okay, so doing that and varying the size n, so n equal 10 here, the sample size equal to 10 up to 100,000. When n equal 10, I rejected the null hypothesis every single time out of 10,000 trials, even though my data was exactly generated from it. Okay, and so as n gets larger, I'm improving on the probability of false discovery, wanting it to be about 5%, wanting it to be no more than 5%. I'm getting much too high probability of false discoveries. And so what the orange bar is showing you is taking into account the distribution from the noise and correcting for it, we can achieve this probability bound on probability of false discovery to still obtain these valid tests, showing that we cannot just use these off-the-shelf methods in this framework.
Okay. What's the power of the test then?
Yeah, good. So I left that out for time. I'll show you right at the very end. Yeah, but that's a very good question.
And privacy. Is that just random variation that for this large n, it actually have gone up?
So all the theory work says that as you add noise to the observed counts, as n gets large, the noise becomes insignificant. And so you just use these off-the-shelf methods, and it should work fine. And so when n is pretty large, we are seeing that sort of behavior, that the classical test is almost working. But for reasonable size data sets, they do horribly. And in fact, like it's not just random variation where we're seeing things like rejecting it sometimes, failing to reject sometimes. We're rejecting it more often. And to, a reason for that is just Jensen's inequality. We're expected to see this higher, even though we're adding mean zero noise.
So the tests, I'm missing, there's the differentially private analysis, and there's just taking into account the noise that you've added in calculating the correct distribution. So
yes.
It's no longer okay. So I'm not sure which of these features are captured here.
So the privacy analysis, so in differential privacy, there's typically a privacy proof and then a utility proof. So the privacy proof is very easy. Adding noise, now we're private. Now the utility is when we actually test these hypotheses, do they perform as they should?
But in the
so this is sort of the utility.
But in the analysis where everything is rejected, they say this blue thing, is it because this classical is using the wrong distribution? Is not taking into account the change in the distribution?
So usually in these classical tests, they look at an asymptotic distribution. And so asymptotically, these are the same distribution. And so for reasonable size.
Usually in pre-1950s. No, they never look at us.
When we add Laplace noise, we're just sort of doing Monte Carlo approach. We're just sampling from the distribution. But when we add Gaussian noise, we can actually find a new distribution that it should be. And so it's no longer chi-squared. It's now like a linear combination of chi-squares with one degree of freedom.
Right. And of course, anyone would use that distribution rather than the asymptotic distribution of training.
Right, but so what we wanted to demonstrate is that these off-the-shelf methods do not work anymore, and you would need a new distribution.
Like the wrong shelf.
Yeah, so it would be nice to see what's the game. You said you were going to tell us.
So let me cut to that right now.
The power and the privacy parameters, just for this example.
So here's our power. So what I'm doing here, so let me explain this. So N, this is the size of my data. This is my power, my empirical power. Was I actually able to reject the null hypothesis? And to see how I'm generating my data, that is, so I'm assuming my null hypothesis is this, but I'm slightly perturbing it by adding this small amount. So my data is generated from this distribution, but I'm testing to see whether it's this. So it's a slight perturbation. And I want to know, was I able to correctly reject the null hypothesis? And so what this top curve is just the classical approach. So this is without noise, so there's no privacy here. And in this curve, what I'm doing is looking at a Monte Carlo approach or looking at this new asymptotic result. Okay. So in this Monte Carlo approach, so they're kind of right on top of each other, kind of showing that our asymptotic result is very close to just sampling from the true distribution. And so we do see that there is a gap, that we're losing power. But as we increase n, we are able to still be able to correctly reject the null hypothesis. So this is sort of the trade-off.
So now the two procedures have become incomparable because one is better in alpha and the other is better in beta. So can you tune them so that...
So what these tests are guaranteed to have probability of false discovery most alpha. So subject to that, now you want to get good power.
So then I don't understand, because then you're saying that the classical is doing better because it has the same alpha.
There's no privacy there, though.
Yeah. I mean,
so you want the constraint of privacy on top of it. So this is the cost of privacy, essentially.
Privacy is a separate cost.
And in follow-up work, I'll show that we can improve on the privacy from these techniques. We just modified the statistic so that asymptotically it's still chi-squared. So we can like reduce a degree of freedom here and actually improve on the power.
But can you tell us just sort of quantitatively what the privacy gain is in this example?
What the privacy gain is?
Yeah, I mean, so you have so the classical one is worse in power, but you're saying the new one.
So
But you're saying the new one is better because you gain privacy. So
this top curve is yes, there's no privacy. I'm using the classical technique, which works.
Yeah.
Okay. But now, my new methods, if I apply the classical off-the-shelf techniques, I am not guaranteed this hard constraint anymore.
Of course.
Right, because the type one errors or the probability of false discovery were way too high.
Okay.
So now I need to correct for that.
So once you do it right, can you just give us, in this example, quantitatively an idea of how much the privacy gain is?
So
privacy has...
The privacy gain, we're just adding on top of this method privacy as a constraint.
But it's not binary, it's not pass-fail.
Yeah, that's right.
You might lose some parameters or all of your privacy.
So the privacy parameters that we're adding here are like epsilon 0.1 and delta is like 1 in 1,000,000.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
So make graphs like this with the gain with respect to that parameter, the loss of privacy.
Yeah, so we've looked at other parameter values for the privacy.
It's if you're doing it in Windows, you know that the users are using internet heavily, but you don't know what they're looking at. You know that they're logged on a lot on the computer, but you don't know which apps are you using. Like, is there some sort of qualitative?
Right. So there's a lot. There's not a full understanding of how we should set these privacy parameters. I know that work that they're doing at Harvard, where they're trying to make this practical for other researchers. These are the parameters that they set. And so these are what they set these parameters to. Obviously, if I set the privacy to be very high, so I'm not really guaranteeing any privacy, then these things will get closer and closer together. I'll be approaching the classical test.
And still, the shapes of those curves might be interesting.
Yeah, so we can look at different parameter values.
There should be some theoretical link between the gain you're supposed to.
Right.
Whatever you lose in, I mean, whatever you lose in power, you should have gained in privacy, right? Should be a link.
Yeah, so we can think of like adding noise. We're sort of adding this variance to our statistics.
This should be a link.
And so this should be like
some sort of.
Yeah. So these are all empirical works, so we don't have precisely this trade-off between like lowering the epsilon, we should be seeing a larger gap in these, and raising it, we should be seeing a smaller. We can empirically show that, but we don't understand precisely what the trade-off is. We're thinking of is like as a rule of thumb, typically it's like a multiplicative 1 over epsilon difference, but these bounds seem to look more additive. Okay, so I did have a slide with future work. We don't fully understand adaptive data analysis. We'd like to know whether some of these approaches are actually practical, whether we can actually show that these things are the way to go, or maybe there's just totally different ways that we should approach adaptive data analysis. I've talked about how max information can be thought of as this sort of unifying measure, but maybe there's other things that unify these things better. We know that there's some methods that generalize in this adaptive setting that do not have a bound on max information. So what is the true unifying measure for all of these? And so is it a necessary condition? And is differential privacy even the right approach? Okay, so some contributions, talked about adaptive data analysis. Fulce has done some work in algorithmic game theory. Again, with privacy being sort of the motivating factor, how can we incorporate privacy as an additional constraint into an otherwise classical problem? You saw this in private hypothesis tests. But in algorithmic game theory, we're thinking of exchange markets where we want to allocate goods in some market where we're not allowed the use of money. And we want to do so in some optimal way, but subject to privacy. And so the application we're thinking of there is in kidney exchanges. Okay, another area I've looked at is kind of utilizing differential privacy as a tool to solve new problems in, where privacy is not really a concern. So we saw this in adaptive data analysis. We were able to utilize some of the stability guarantees of differential privacy. And here, what I want to do is use it to solve new problems in algorithmic game theory, so we can show that we can create some coordination devices to help coordinate agents who do not know all of the utilities of all the other players in the game. So can we still coordinate them to some desirable strategy, such as some equilibrium behavior or socially optimal behavior? Okay, I've also looked at different algorithmic game theory type problems where privacy is not really introduced at all. Looked at Walration equilibrium prices. Can they be used as a coordination device where we don't need to tell every person how they should buy goods in a market? We can just publish the prices and the market will clear. Also, I've looked at problems in reveal preferences and most recently in ongoing work from my internship at MSR New York over the summer, I look at problems in prediction markets. That's it. Thanks.
Does the computational cost come into play as well? For example, in your new example, if the problem was a little harder and you had a covariance structure you're supposed to, that's unknown, but you know that it exists, then you could ask a variety of questions that have to do with correlation among variables, but you could also just run an algorithm that fits the full covariance matrix or some PCA model or factor analysis model on that data. And then you can answer many questions of that type.
Yep.
It would cost more than just running an analysis of two variables.
Yep.
So then if you keep on asking questions in your manner, asking particular questions about variables or particular hypotheses or estimate particular quantities in sequence, then maybe there is a computational gain over just fitting everything. And maybe that's another variable that you put in addition to the other considerations you had there.
Yeah, so it's sort of like upfront, perhaps you can like create some synthetic data set or something where you can sort of ask whatever you want on top of it and somehow achieve some utility guarantees. So there's been work definitely in that area of differential privacy. Producing the synthetic data set would depend on what possible questions you would ask it, so maybe some class of questions that you would ask. And then you can, it's actually hard to create some synthetic data set that will achieve some accuracy on like all the questions that you could possibly ask it. So rather in this adaptive setting, kind of thinking of just add noise and do something on top of it. So maybe there's a computational gain in just this adaptive sequence.
Questions? Go for it. All right, let's thank Ryan again.